Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're exploring Kurdish oral history. We want to look at why it's so significant for understanding, well, Kurdish culture, memory, and identity.
We've got quite a bit to work with today. Our main source is the Living Archive, an exploration of Kurdish oral history, which really goes into detail. But we also have some other materials giving different perspectives, adding more context.
Right. And our goal today is to figure out why these spoken traditions have been just so vital for the Kurds, you know, as a large stateless nation. We'll try to uncover some of the fascinating stories of people who've kept this heritage alive. And we'll also touch on the challenges it's facing now and what's being done to preserve it. Okay, so first things first. It seems like for centuries, actually, just telling stories out loud was the main way Kurdish language, history, values, even social norms got passed down.
Absolutely. For generations, oral transmission was, well, key. Mm-hmm. And that includes everything, you know, storytelling, songs, reciting epics, proverbs, even knowledge that's sort of embodied in practices.
And why such a heavy reliance on the spoken word?
Well, part of it is down to the political fragmentation of Kurdistan, the land being divided, and also, you know, policies in different places aimed at suppressing written Kurdish that made oral traditions even more crucial.
And it's the individuals who keep these traditions going, isn't it? Figures like the Dengbej and the Zarbej. Can you tell us more about them?
Yes, they're absolutely central. The Dengbej, it literally means master of the voice. They're traditionally the male singer poets or bards. They perform kilim, these recital songs covering history, epics, love, loss, everyday life. A huge range.
And the Zarbej.
The Zarbej, often women, are increasingly recognized as the source creators for many of these oral forms. And some research even suggests they might have originated the Dengbej tradition itself.
Wow. So they're like living archives in a way.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it.
And their work keeping these traditions going, it's been a way to maintain Kurdish culture against, well, all sorts of pressures.
Exactly. It's been a real strategy for cultural survival. Resilience against political pressure, against assimilation attempts. When writing was difficult or even risky, these oral forms were the lifeline for cultural continuity, for that shared sense of history.
Okay, so when we talk about these oral histories, there are some incredible myths and epics at the foundation, right? Stories that really shape Kurdish identity.
Absolutely. Kurdish oral history is incredibly rich with these narratives. And often, you know, they blend influences from neighbors, but still keep a distinct Kurdish character.
Let's dig into some of those. The sources mention some pretty intriguing origin tales. King Solomon and jinns. That sounds quite mystical.
It is. And what's interesting about those legends linking Kurdish origins to King Solomon and jinns is that they were often recorded by outsiders, Judaic scholars, early Islamic writers. And while they offer an origin story, sometimes these tales had negative connotations. There's even this idea of ancestors being thrown away, Yugruduhuna, into the mountains.
That's quite a narrative. Very different, it seems, from the Kawa and Zahak myth. That feels much more central, maybe.
Oh, the Kawa myth is foundational. And it carries immense political weight, too. It's the story of the evil king Zahak, serpents on his shoulders, needing daily sacrifices, just bringing darkness. And then Kawa, the blacksmith, who defies him.
The one who saved the youths and led the rebellion.
That's the one. He's this powerful symbol of liberation from tyranny, and it's all tied up with New Rose celebrations, the Kurdish New Year.
So Kawa is a big symbol for Kurdish nationalism.
A very potent one, yes. Mm. And different political movements have used that symbolism over time to rally support.
And then there's Shamaran, the half-human, half-snake goddess figure. She sounds fascinating.
Shamaran is another really interesting mythical figure, often female, protector of secrets, goddess of wisdom. Her story often contrasts this feminine wisdom with, you know, masculine tyranny like Zahak's, and her death yields powerful elixirs, adding to her symbolic depth.
Powerful stories indeed. And it seems there are connections, overlaps with other cultures in the region too.
Yes, definitely. If you look at the bigger picture, you see things like the Simurgh bird from Iranian tradition appearing in Kurdish tales as Simir. And there are parallels with Armenian epics, too, especially in origin stories for ruling families in places like Sasan and Bidlis. It points to a long history of cultural exchange.
Okay, moving beyond the core myths, there are these foundational epics and folktales. Mm-hmm. Mem-Uzin is mentioned as a masterpiece.
Ah, Mem-Uzin. Yes, it's really considered a cornerstone of Kurdish literature, a tragic romance, echoes of Romeo and Juliet, perhaps. What's compelling is that it existed orally for centuries before Emadi Zani wrote it down in the 17th century.
And versions exist in other languages, too.
That's right. Neo-Aramaic, Armenian versions exist. it shows its broad cultural significance.
Then there's Dim Dim. That sounds more historical.
Dim Dim is based on a real event, the 17th century siege of Dim Dim Fortress. It's about Emirzan Lepsurun's rebellion against Shah Abbas I of the Safavids. So this epic is a powerful way of keeping the memory of Kurdish resistance alive.
We also see mentions of Zembelfrosh, the basket seller, and the Keselok tales, the clever bald boy. These sound a bit different.
They are, yeah. Zembelfrosh is about a prince who chooses a humble life, resists temptation. It echoes the story of Joseph, actually. Very popular in parts of Kurdistan.
And Keselok.
The Keselok tales feature this trickster figure. They offer humor, social commentary. You see similar figures in Turkish and Persian traditions, too. And, of course, you have proverbs, riddles, and these shorter forms are vital, too, packing cultural wisdom into just a few words.
So it's clear these myths and epics, they do much more than just entertain. They're really laying the groundwork for the culture, explaining origins, justifying traditions.
Exactly. They provide foundational narratives. They legitimize practices like Nuroz through the Kawa myth. They offer historical examples of resistance. And they deeply encode cultural values, a shared history. That emphasis on resisting tyranny, it provides a symbolic language that still resonates hugely today.
Let's circle back to the people who carry these stories, the Dengbej and Zarbej. We know who they are generally, but what about the specifics of their art, their role?
Well, they really are the living archive. The Dengbej, these masters of the voice, they perform kilam, weaving history, epics, personal stories, social commentary all together. Their performances were often central to community life. The way they sing, the improvisation, it all adds to the impact, makes the story stick.
So they weren't just singers, they were carrying history, carrying language itself.
Precisely. That's their significance. Custodians of collective memory, history, language, culture. And they often offer alternative views to, you know, the official state histories. They preserve older forms of Kurdish language, too.
And their performance style.
Typically unaccompanied vocals. Often improvised. It's very distinctive, very powerful emotionally.
It's interesting how their social standing shifted. Supported by tribal leaders, then sometimes criticized by modern political movements.
That's right. Historically, they often had close ties to tribal leaders. But then, with modern political movements emerging, especially mid-20th century, they were sometimes seen as symbols of an older, maybe feudal past. Their social position definitely evolved.
But there's been a revival more recently, hasn't there? A renewed appreciation.
Yes, a pretty significant revival started around the early 2000s. It was driven by this growing emphasis on cultural and linguistic rights in Kurdish politics, renewed interest from intellectuals, artists, and crucially, active support from Kurdish cultural institutions. Places like the Mesopotamia Cultural Centers, the NCM, and local municipalities really got behind it.
Leading to more visibility. Festivals, Dengbej houses.
Exactly. More public performances, festivals, dedicated Dengbej houses, more TV appearances. It brought them back into the public eye.
Bringing figures like Evdilay Zeneke, Karpatik Shaso back into focus, and newer ones like Salihe Shuneksi.
Precisely. These names, historical and contemporary, represent that enduring legacy.
Now let's talk more about the women, the Zarbej. It sounds like their role was maybe historically overlooked.
Well, research is increasingly highlighting just how crucial Zarbej women were. As the original creators, the source creators, of many oral forms, laments, songs, folktales, stories.
So maybe even originating the Dengbej tradition itself.
Some scholars suggest exactly that, that they were the ones who originated the art of singing kilam, the very foundation.
But performing publicly was often restricted for them.
Yes, often limited by social customs, patriarchal structures. But women from all sorts of backgrounds in Mesopotamia played this vital role in preserving oral heritage. Often under really difficult circumstances, you know, political oppression, language bans, sometimes using pseudonyms or recording outside their homeland.
Are there names we should know?
Figures like Elmas Muhammad, Myram Zan, Aisha Shan. Their contributions are now getting more recognition.
And there are specific projects trying to document their work now.
Yes, thankfully. Institutions like the Kurdish Heritage Institute and specific initiatives focusing on Zarbej and Dengbej women are actively working to document and celebrate their contributions. It's important work.
This revival of Dengbeji, framing it as authentic Kurdish heritage, sounds like it's tied into contemporary identity politics, maybe even economics.
That's a very sharp point. Yes, its reemergence is deeply linked with current Kurdish identity politics and cultural commodification, too. The shift from seeing it as perhaps a relic of the past to being the embodiment of authentic culture that was actively shaped by Kurdish political and cultural actors.
So it becomes both a political symbol and a cultural product.
Exactly. Which leads to complexities. Issues around politicization, performances being taken out of context.
Like performing for tourists, maybe.
Right. That can happen. Which sparks debates, you know, about authenticity versus just sharing the culture more widely. And also, the focus often stays on the male Dengbejes, potentially sidelining the women's contributions again.
It's incredibly layered. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. How are these oral histories actually passed down? What are the mechanics of transmission?
Well, several key ways. With speaking and listening being central, obviously. Storytelling is fundamental, both formal, like with Dengbeje, and informal, you know, within families, from elders.
And music is huge too, right?
Absolutely massive. Yeah. Song and music, the Kilem, folk songs, even sacred music in communities like the Alehuf. They're powerful ways to carry history, values, religious knowledge. And there's this concept, Sina Wasina, chest to chest.
Chest to chest. What does that mean?
It describes this really deep, embodied person-to-person transfer of knowledge. Through spoken words, yes, but also performance, shared memory, the whole sensory experience within the community. Think of a grandmother teaching a traditional song, not just the notes and words, but the feeling, the stories behind it. That's Sina Wasina.
So it's much more than just the text. It's the whole shared experience.
Precisely. And that happens in everyday life. Family settings, community events, weddings, funerals, festivals like Newroz, religious ceremonies, even diaspora events are vital spaces now.
And the shorter forms, too. Proverbs, riddles?
Yep. They play their part. And in traditions like Dengbeje, you have that direct master-apprentice relationship, passing skills and knowledge directly.
You mentioned earlier how important this is for a stateless nation. How does this oral history connect with collective memory and maybe even trauma?
Well, it's absolutely crucial for linguistic continuity, cultural knowledge, political awareness, identity, especially for people without a state, like the Kurds. Oral history provides that access to collective memory, which is fundamental for building community.
Especially when there's been so much shared trauma, I imagine.
Yes, the transmission of trauma, sometimes called post-memory, is a really significant aspect. Later generations inherit these traumatic memories from their families through the stories they hear, commemorations, rituals. And this shapes their identity, their political outlook.
So remembering becomes a form of resistance.
In many ways, yes. When official histories deny or twist Kurdish experiences, oral history counters that. Recounting past suffering, past resistance, becomes an act of asserting group identity, unifying the community.
And this continues even when people move away, in the diaspora.
Absolutely. Diaspora communities actively engage in what you could call memory work. Cultural events, commemorations, language classes, all ways to pass on historical knowledge, foster identity, especially for younger generations born outside Kurdistan.
Though those memories might evolve in the new context.
They do. Diasporic memories aren't static. They interact with the experiences in the new homeland.
So Kurdish oral history sounds like this incredible tapestry, weaving personal stories with collective ones, always being shaped and reshaped through telling and retelling.
Exactly. It's a dynamic process, making meaning of the past right here in the present. And you really see that in how traumatic memories are carried across generations and geography. The context of telling, family chat, public performance, it all shapes how it's understood.
Now, thinking about how spread out the Kurdish people are geographically, it makes sense there'd be regional differences in these traditions.
Yes, absolutely. The division across modern borders, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria, the Caucasus, plus the diaspora, has created very different political environments. And while there are common threads, these different contexts, different languages, different historical paths have definitely shaped distinct regional oral traditions.
Those 20th century borders really carved things up, didn't they? Leading to very different experiences.
Hugely different. You look at Turkey, there were harsh assimilation policies. In Iraq, terrible repression, the Anfal genocide. The sheer scale of Anfal means its memory is incredibly potent in Iraqi Kurdish oral traditions.
Right. And Iran, Syria.
Iran had Persianization efforts. Yeah. Syria had its own complex path under the French mandate and then Ba'athist rule. These distinct political journeys deeply influenced the focus of oral traditions in each place.
And the linguistic diversity within Kurdish itself must add another layer.
It does. You have Kurmanji, Sorani, Zazaki, Gorani, Laki Harami. Different dialects. Not always easily mutually intelligible. So oral traditions live in these different linguistic forms, reflecting the local vernaculars. Kurmanji, for example, might have ancient roots tied to orally transmitted religious texts. The very vitality of the oral tradition is linked to the health of these dialects.
So if you were listening to oral histories from different regions, you might hear quite different stories, different emphases.
Precisely. In Turkey, you might hear more about assimilation, state violence, displacement, borders seen as foreign impositions. In Iraq, the focus could be on struggles against Iraqi regimes, onfall, refugee experiences, the KRG. The Beamton University Project, for instance, captures Iraqi Kurdish refugee stories in the U.S.
And Syria and Iran?
Syria might have memories of the French Mandate,
yep.
Refuge for Kurds fleeing Turkey, but also later suppression. Iran connects to older events like Dimdim, but also experiences under the Pahlavis and the Islamic Republic.
And the diaspora.
Diaspora narratives often center on migration, adaptation, that sense of post-memory, negotiating identity, keeping ties to the homeland.
It's clear these regional variations really show the impact of political fragmentation, the different state experiences.
Yes, they shape the content, the emphasis, even within that broader shared Kurdish identity.
But this incredibly rich tradition, it's facing some serious challenges today, isn't it?
It really is. Significant threats, ongoing political pressures, conflict, big socioeconomic shifts, and just the practical difficulties of preservation now.
Political repression, assimilation policies, they haven't gone away.
Unfortunately not, in many places. Language bans in schools, media, public life, they still hinder passing traditions on. Censorship, controlling performances, closing cultural centers, it all creates obstacles. Plus the destruction of materials and just the climate of fear that can lead to self-censorship.
And the impact of actual conflict, even genocide, must be devastating for an oral tradition.
Profoundly so. You lose the knowledge bearers, the elders, the storytellers, the Dengbejes. Communities get disrupted by forced displacement, breaking those transmission networks. Trauma itself can affect memory, how stories are told. And just documenting things in conflict zones is incredibly hard.
Then there are the challenges from modernization, technology.
Yeah, it's complex. Urbanization, changing lifestyles mean fewer traditional communal gatherings like the Subbuhirk, where stories were shared. Media competition, TV, internet, social media pulls attention away, especially for younger people. There can be a generational gap.
But technology can help preserve things too, surely.
It's a double-edged sword. It offers tools for recording, archiving, sharing. But that needs resources, technical know-how. And you face issues like data management, formats becoming obsolete.
And what about this idea of commodification, turning it into heritage?
Yes, that's another tricky area. When traditions are framed as cultural heritage, performances might get staged for media, for tourism. That can change the form, strip away the original context. It leads to debates about authenticity, about who owns what was once collective material. And sometimes the content gets simplified for wider appeal.
And maybe one of the most fundamental challenges is just time passing, losing elders, language shifting.
Absolutely. When elderly knowledge keepers pass away, that loss is irreplaceable. And linguistic assimilation, especially among youth, threatens the very dialects these traditions live in.
Finally, just the practical side of archiving this stuff sounds like a huge task.
It is. There's often a scarcity of resources for collecting, documenting, digitizing, preserving. And then you have all the political and ethical knots to untangle: access, censorship, intellectual property rights, how to engage ethically with the communities whose heritage it is.
So modernity is a real paradox here.
It really is. Technology offers lifelines for preservation, but at the same time, social and economic changes chip away at the traditional contexts where these traditions thrived. Preservation efforts can risk turning a living practice into a museum piece. The challenge is ensuring it stays relevant, alive, for future generations.
Hannah the Chai Lady's here. Roj Bosch, Hannah.
Oh, perfect timing. Yeah. Just what we needed.
Oh, this smells wonderful today, Hannah. Is it your usual blend? You know, it's got a lovely warmth, not too bitter at all. Maybe just a tiny touch more sugar for my taste, but it's really quite good. What do you think?
Yes, it's a very pleasant brew today. The balance of spices is just right. Perhaps a small amount of sugar would enhance the sweetness, but it's certainly enjoyable as it is. Thank you, Hannah.
Right, a little pause to savor this wonderful chai. We'll be right back.
Right. Welcome back. Before the chai break, we were deep into the challenges facing Kurdish oral history today. But it's not all doom and gloom, is it? There are significant efforts to preserve and revitalize this heritage. Yes, thankfully. In response to these challenges, we've seen this real increase in archiving, research, revitalization work. Some scholars even call it an archival turn in Kurdish studies.
Can you tell us about some of the key players, the institutions doing this work?
Well, there are several important ones. The Kurdish Heritage Institute, KHI, based in Soleimani, is a major one. They focus specifically on the oral culture of all the peoples of Kurdistan. They do systematic collection, digital preservation, publications, events, collaborations. Really comprehensive work.
And others?
There's the Zine Center, also in Soleimani, more focused on written heritage, but they work with KHI. In the U.S., Binghamton University Libraries has a significant collection and runs the Kurdish Oral History Project, focusing particularly on diaspora stories, Iraqi Kurds in the U.S.
And in Turkey, those Mesopotamia cultural centers, the NCHM.
Absolutely crucial. They've been operating since the 90s, really grassroots level, promoting Kurdish language, arts, culture. They were pivotal in that Dengbeji revival we talked about, organizing festivals, setting up Dengbej houses.
Even though they face pressure themselves.
Yes, they face significant state pressure, closures at times, but their impact has been huge. And there are other archives, too. University of Lausanne, ISH in Amsterdam, Radio Yerevan's old recordings, University of Exeter.
So this archival turn, it signifies a real shift.
I think so. A move towards engaging more with Kurdish sources, not just relying on state archives of the major powers. Digitization helps, Cold War archives opening up, more access to non-state archives. It's changing the landscape.
Creating new opportunities for research.
Definitely. Opportunities to look at underdocumented periods, to ground research in Kurdish perspectives, using richer source material.
But it comes with challenges, too, this turn.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Methodological ones. How do you integrate all these diverse sources? Political ones, access, censorship, are still real issues. Ethical ones, handling sensitive material, the dilemmas of digitization, ownership. And conceptually, it pushes us to rethink older frameworks for understanding Kurdish history.
And beyond just archiving, what about active research, revitalization efforts?
Academic research, particularly in anthropology and history, is using oral history more and more to understand memory, identity, trauma. Building on earlier work, you know, by Austro-Hungarian and Soviet scholars even, and there's ongoing folklore collection, trying to preserve endangered traditions and also challenge dominant narratives.
It sounds like modern Kurdish literature is getting involved, too.
Yes, that's a really interesting development. Writers like Mehmet Uzun, Mehmet Dikel, they're consciously drawing on folklore, on oral narrative structures, incorporating Dengbej figures. It's a way to enrich the literature, but also to revitalize the language, connect back to those cultural roots.
So these archives, these efforts, they're more than just storing old stuff. They're politically significant spaces.
Exactly. Archives are never neutral. They reflect power dynamics. Who gets to collect? Whose stories are preserved? Who gets access? These are all contested issues tied deeply to Kurdish identity and the right to narrate their own history.
This has been such a comprehensive look at a huge topic. If we were to try and sum up, what are the key takeaways about Kurdish oral history?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's this incredible testament to resilience, how a people preserve their identity across borders through immense hardship, primarily through the spoken word. It's a dynamic tradition carrying history, memory, but also offering ways to resist, to be creative.
But it's facing real threats now.
Absolutely. Political repression, conflict, modernization, the challenges are significant.
Yeah.
Which makes the ongoing efforts in archiving, research, revitalization so incredibly crucial. They're trying to safeguard this heritage.
And that archival turn is important, but complex.
Yes, it highlights the need for diverse sources for Kurdish perspectives,
yeah.
But it brings those tricky ethical and political questions with it. Ultimately, I think the enduring power of Kurdish oral history isn't just about preserving the past. It's about ensuring its continued life, its transmission, as a vital source of identity and understanding for Kurds today and tomorrow.
That's a powerful note to end on, and maybe something for you, listening at home, to think about. What role do oral traditions play in your own community, your own family? What stories are passed down? How do they shape how you see the past and the present? And what challenges might those traditions face today? What needs to happen to make sure they continue? Thank you for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.